oscura.
So, Arnie, do I tap first or
not? At the same time. Tap and say your, yep. And then say it right after you tap it.
Just sit here.
Call to order.
I'll call this meeting to order. Welcome. I'm not Sarah or Representative Gelser. She is a little under the weather and went home, and so we're kind of pinch hitting here. We are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 428. And Secretary of State Kate Brown and Senator Metzger, if you would please. And then would you please give us a quick rundown of Senate Bill 428 adds the State Treasurer and Secretary of State to the State Board of Education as non-voting members. And there's a committee amendment recommended which would eliminate the possibility of those individuals appointing a representative rather than attending them personally. Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. And thank you for hearing Senate Bill 428. This bill is simple in many respects, but I think it also extremely important in others. In this building, we have been talking a lot, certainly about financial literacy, with where our country is. A lot of the bills we deal with are trying to take care of the card after it's left the door in terms of consumer protection, others that are related to financial issues, and certainly in terms of civics, in making sure that our young people understand the importance of being involved in the process, how that process works. It's disturbing when I saw in a poll last year that over 40% of Oregon's kids didn't even know we had two U.S. senators, much less who they were, what they did. And so these are really important issues, is that we make sure that, you know, our students understand finances, understand that role in the economy, and understand also the civic responsibility and the fact that they can make a difference. This bill adds the Secretary of State and the Treasurer, who represent two of those very, very important issues, the elections portion of our state government, and also the state treasurer, the financial aspects of that, as ex officio members to the Board of Education, so that we send a very, very clear message to the students and to our citizens that at the highest elected officials in those areas are going to be engaged in those discussions before the board. I think it's really, really important that not only those voices are heard, but also, again, that it sends a message that we take this very seriously. We don't just talk about education, the need to get people involved, but that we actually make sure that the people who are leading us in those areas are represented in that capacity. I'll answer one question that you might have in advance. Well, why would you add them and or their designee? And the reality is that with the Board of Education, they have real jobs to do, and they can't necessarily go to every Board of Education meeting. By having their designee, I know, Secretary Brown and Michael will also comment on the State Treasurer, are having people in their staff who are engaged in this issue and make sure that they can, even if they cannot attend, that someone can and be there and represent their offices if there's any particular issues. But that provides the flexibility necessary so they can do their jobs as well. So with that, Madam Chair, I will conclude, and if it's your will, I'll turn it over to Secretary Brown.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you. For the record, Kate Brown, Oregon's current Secretary of State. Thanks so much for hearing Senate Bill 428. I think this is a really important bill. One of my top priorities during the election cycle was to work to get young people engaged in the political process. And this election cycle, we saw a huge turnout by young people in the state. The actual turnout was at about 69%. That is not very typical of most elections. Most election cycle, young people vote in about 20% level of turnout. And by young people, don't want to offend anybody on the committee, but it means folks under the age of 30. So, sorry, guys. In any event, I see this as a huge issue for my office by being an ex officio member of the Department of the Board of Education, not the Department of Education. I think I can work with the board to establish criteria that's appropriate to determine when students have met the essential skills of public service and civic engagement. I will share that there's a class here from Portland Community College that I met with earlier, the Cascade campus that I met with earlier today, and we talked about this as a way, as a tool that I can use to make sure that we are promoting civic education in the schools. I think it's extremely important that we do so at both the middle school and the high school levels. One of our tools that Oregon has used was allowing young people to register at the age of 17, when they can't vote then until they're 18. I do believe that online voter registration will also promote youth engagement as well. So I appreciate you hearing this bill. I'm more than happy to answer any questions. I do have to buzz off quickly. So
in the interest of time, committee, if we have any questions for the Secretary of State or the Senator, let's do that, and then if we can move on with you, Michael. Representative Robler.
Thank you. It's so honored to have these people here, and I worry at times that we're overpowering this board with executive members of the executive branch. And I have found out that the executive branch is a little different, and the governor appointing is different from the treasurer and the secretary of state. And I guess, is that a problem when you have these other people who are coming from public life, you know, all over the state, not being teachers or others, but people who come with their ideas from there? And then we have two fairly important elected officials. Is that going to have an influence on those other people when they sit at that board? And that's just a concern that I have, and I'd just like to hear from.
Well, my standpoint, Representative, that would not be a concern I would have. I think, first of all, the people that serve on the board, as most of them are appointed because of their strength in areas, and I've never, in my appearances working with OSAA issues and others before the board, they're very strong-willed individuals. So I don't think they would be taking a back seat to anything. And then keep in mind also that it's the voices that I think are important on those issues, and what I think it, you know, tells the citizenry of the state, and that is why they're ex officio members. So they're not voting members of the board, but they can contribute their wisdom on thoughts that are germane to their offices, and I think that's valuable. But I do not see they don't have a vote, but number two, I think the members of the Board of Education are very strong, and I don't think we'll necessarily feel wilting in front of the opinions of either the secretary or the treasurer.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I would agree with Senator Metzger. I think the ex officio status probably resolves that power differential, so to speak. I will be really frank. I think the focus of my work on this board will be around civic engagement, getting young people educated about our voting process, making sure they're filling out the ballots correctly, that sort of thing, and how we can have them meet their essential skills. Amy Wilson from my office is the civic engagement program coordinator, I would see would probably most likely be my designee on this position. But I think the other thing I would say is that both the treasurer and the secretary of state sit on the state land board, the purpose of which is to oversee our common school fund and maximize revenue for K through 12 schools. I think it's really important that there be some, while it's a somewhat limited connection, a connection with our role on that particular board and this one, and I think it makes sense to connect the two. This bill does that very creatively.
Paula? So my only other concern on this bill has been the politicizing of the board, that this might cause more of that, where you have people who come in from either of those offices, no matter what, to use it as a place to express ideas and other views, or when very controversial issues that come up in the course of a conversation that the board has to deal with, all of a sudden it becomes a political hot potato for maybe some of the people who just put on this board. And I think those are times a problem also with the land board. I mean, I think they found themselves in the same position. But here it's this interaction with this other group, and I just want to be sure that it isn't something that would be used in what I would consider negative political ways.
Madam Chair, Representative Robland, I appreciate your concerns. I think they're legitimate. In my role as the head of Elections Division, I'm very cognizant of the fact that it's really important that when we are running programs like elections that we keep them as, postpartisan, as nonpartisan as possible. I think that's true with this role as well.
Okay. Just wanted to get that on the record. I appreciate that.
Did I see another question down there earlier? Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for being here. I recognize the problem. I see the proposed solution. I remember hearing from the Treasurer about the very large number of boards he already serves on, and I imagine that there are comparable numbers for the Secretary of State. Is my initial concern when I saw this was that it might be a feel-good bill that would help us feel like we were doing something about the very real problems that you've addressed, but simultaneously add to the amount of work that you folks already need to perform without necessarily reaping any real benefit. Think I'm wrong?
Madam Chair, Representative Harker, no, I always think you're right.
Okay, I'm out of here now.
Sure. I can't speak to the Treasurer's duties in terms of the boards. The boards I'm actually serving on are fairly limited. In addition to the State Land Board, I'm chairing the Oregon Sustainability Board. There may be a couple others that I'm not thinking of right now. I do believe that my office has the time and energy to commit to this position because the issue of civic engagement is so critical to the future of our democracy, and I'm just very committed to filling that role. I think I haven't spoken directly with the Treasurer in response to your question, but I know the issue. I've heard him speak a number of times in regards to the issue of financial education. I know it is a priority for his office as well. So,
and I would just like to make one comment on that, Representative. And part of the role of being an ex officio member is that the reality is not every board meeting is going to be dealing with those issues. So the reality is you're not going to see the State Treasurer or the Secretary at every board meeting. But on those areas in which they are covering topics that are related to those issues is when they would most likely attend and give their perspective.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Comp.
Well, I'll defer to Representative Denbrough. He was first in the queue.
Okay, Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the the effort at interaction and engagement that this bill represents. I do have a concern about the need to actually have a formal for these offices to have a formal position on the board, even if it's ex officio. And I say that just from my own experience. I sat on the board for a few years, and I would say that the amount of time that would be spent on relevant issues is really very limited. I think issues of potentially civic engagement and financial management, I think might account for about 5% of the time. And while I think it would be really useful to have someone sitting in the meetings and being there testifying at appropriate times, et cetera, really engaging, I'm just not sure that there actually needs to be a formal position put on the board for that purpose. The governor's office has a representative, James Sager, who would attend many of the meetings and would, particularly when relevant issues were on the agenda, and then would come before us, and that seems more like the kind of model that would make sense to me, at least initially. And then if it seemed as if the there was a need for a more formal position, then you do that. So I am, and let me just say, I haven't studied this issue at all. I don't know if you heard from people on the State Board of Ed about their thoughts about this when the bill first was heard, and I guess that would be my question. Have you heard from them? And then the question of, don't you think that adequate representation could come in a more informal manner.
Well, I'll start with that one, Representative. I just sit on the Education Committee as well. Either public hearings or even since have had any engagement from any of the board on this. The department was in but not the board. But to your more specific question, one of the things that I think is important about this is that you talked about the 5% time frame, and you're probably absolutely right about that. But I would argue that that's part of the problem, is that our boards are supposed to be visionary and laying out policy, and we need to spend more time on it. I've been working with Representative Wisnett the last couple of sessions on financial literacy. And the reality is, the board has not been receptive to the essential skill of financial literacy. And there's a lot of reasons, but I'm not condemning them for that. But it's the old adage in education that if it's not assessed, it's not taught. And I think part of the thing is having the secretary and the treasurer represented on that board is that it raises those issues to a higher level. It raises the opportunity and the focus to spend a bit more time on these very important issues of civics and financial engagement for our students, and move it above that 5%. And one of the reasons we feel this is important is that when that focus is there, that vision may also be more focused as well.
And just to follow up, I don't know if you're aware that the board meets monthly, and there's a substantial time commitment. It's all day on Thursday, 8:30 to 4 or 5, and then half a day on Friday. So it's quite a substantial commitment.
Yeah, and again, you're absolutely right. I've been in a number of those meetings, not all that time frame. But again, this provides the opportunity for those issues, whether it's dealing with essential skills or whatever that agenda may be, in which it may be important for the treasurer or to the secretary to attend during that portion of the meeting. And as I mentioned before, I do not anticipate, and nor would they would say the same thing, they're going to go to every meeting. But when they start dealing with those types of issues, you would expect that they would be there for those.
Okay. There's two more in the queue, and then if it's committee's will, I'll have Michael weigh in for a little bit, because I know we have Senator Morissette out in the hall. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair. And I'll be very brief, because most of the thoughts that I had in reviewing this bill before coming today have been addressed. But just that people, I'm not in opposition to this bill at all, but just to the framework for the entire committee, I'm a person that would like to have one board of education, that is the State Board of Education, higher ed combined. There's currently, I believe, 17 or 18 members on the higher ed board, plus the board members for higher ed, and we continue to talk about the education continuum. And my feeling is, sometimes instead of talking about adding people, we need to talk about how to restructure for the best model for our state and our students.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I was giving you a promotion, sorry. Senator.
Well, I'm not so sure it's a promotion. Or a demotion, so. You guys have more fun over there.
Definitely.
Yeah.
What were the objections of those who objected in the House, in the Senate chamber?
There was very little discussion on it in the Senate chamber. There wasn't, if I can fairly characterize this as it's been a while, there wasn't objection of substance, I don't think, that was ever brought up. Some people just like voting no. I know there were six or seven that did. But I cannot recall that there was any substantive objection.
Thank you. Certainly, I don't want to rush you off.
Well, I have
Senator,
two people in chicken suits in my business committee
asking
to be abolished from their prior commission, and I think they're getting rather warm and waiting for me to return. So if I could, I would return to my committee.
They could get down.
Thank you for your time. I'm wondering if we all want to join that committee meeting.
Well, Madam Chair, I did open. We have three OLCC bills and the prior commission bill on, and I just wanted to make sure the public realized that the fact that we're dealing with alcohol today and people were showing up in chicken suits may have some kind of cause-effect relationship, so
I
better to see what's happening.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. Michael, thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Chair Springer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer, and I'm here today to convey State Treasurer Ben Westland's support of Senate Bill 428. I won't restate the mechanics of the legislation, but I'll briefly note that the Treasurer is committed to improving Oregon's K-12 system, and that Senate Bill 428 provides a valuable link between local financial infrastructure and local education, and those two items are very necessary to each other's success. The State Treasurer's Office already oversees capital financing, administers funds, runs the Reading Instant Investment Scholarship, and serves as a trustee for the Common School Fund and the Education Stability Fund, both. The bill is a great opportunity to connect the state's financial resources to its educational goals, and I'll just reiterate the Treasurer's support. And I'll address Representative Harker's question regarding the level of commissions and boards that the Treasury serves on by saying that we do feel that we have the time and energy over at the Treasury to make this change, particularly for two reasons. For one, this does allow the flexibility of having a designee serve on the board rather than the Treasurer himself. And also, most boards and commissions that the Treasurer or a designee serve on currently actually require, albeit prudently, staff support from the Treasury staff. And this bill makes no such requirement.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes.
Down there.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
A designee, give me an example of who a designee might be. Would it be somebody who works within the office, or would it be somebody out that you just know of in the community that would maybe serve the purpose outlined?
Chair Springer, Representative Thatcher, I don't believe that it's spelled out in the bill, and we haven't gotten very involved in talking about who our designees may or may not be. But I can tell you that currently I can't think of any designee position that we have in the Treasury that's not filled by a member of the Treasury staff. Whether that would be continued or not is a discussion that we haven't yet engaged in.
Thank you.
But it's certainly an option.
Any other questions? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Springer. I have amendments that struck out designee.
We were having a discussion about that just a couple minutes ago. If you could just, Keeley, speak a couple minutes to that for us.
The only real information I have about that is from Kevin, your normal committee administrator, who said that those were submitted by him at Representative Gelser's request, and that's really all of the information that I have.
Okay, so they would, follow up. So these were generated by this committee, not by the Senate committee.
That's correct.
Thank you. Okay. So anyway, the amendments strike out designee.
Any other?
It hasn't been amended yet.
Question?
Yeah. That amendment has not passed.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're not in a work session, so
we're not
going to work the amendment today.
Right. I would assume that you would want to at least check back in with your chair who requested that those be submitted, and I didn't have that information in a timely enough manner to do that before today's meeting.
But if Michael's here, maybe he'd like to respond to that while he's here, or he could come back for the work session.
Certainly. I mean, he's here, and that's basically all that they do is eliminate the portion that allows for a designee.
Chair Springer, members of the committee, without seeing the exact text of the amendments, I can pretty well guess what that text would read, I would want to take that back to the office and look over that with the executive services staff, but I would venture to guess that removing that flexibility would likely impose a bit of a strain on our schedule.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, we will close the public hearing on
I thought we had more people coming up. I have a very brief question. The same question of, I think, the representative from the Secretary of State's office. If we were to adopt the amendments.
Well, why don't you come forward?
And Michael, we need you again.
And identify yourself.
Michael? No, it's the same question. It's the same question that Michael just asked. I was wondering if the Secretary of State's office might have the same feeling about the amendment.
Chair Representative Parker, for the record, my name is Amy Wilson. I'm the Civic Engagement Program Administrator for the Secretary of State's Office. I think I would have the same reaction as Michael, that I think we would have to take it back to our staff. I do think that it is helpful to have the same staff person working with the with the member, with the treasurer, with the Secretary of State, because ultimately that person's probably going to work on the issues. So I think to the extent sometimes the lead staff on the issue being there instead of the Secretary or the Treasurer is not always a terrible thing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Van Orman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Springer. As long as Amy is here, my understanding from the Secretary of State was that you were going to be the designee.
Mm-hmm. You seem to have all found that at the same time, Representative.
I see, okay.
I think that that's consistent with the work that I do. One of the things that I'm charged to do is deal with civic engagement. Okay. We're looking to develop a program. What I will say is that, since I got called up here, it does give us an opportunity, I think, when... I think we have had a couple of questions about putting, I don't want to say mandates, but asking schools to do things. And I think that when we have our members sitting on the board, it makes a difference because we understand what kind of restraint schools are under instead of us sort of coming forward and saying, here's a program you have. We have a better sense of how our program can fit into what the board's already doing.
Mm-hmm. Cross-fertilization.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yes, Representative Kimbrough.
Thank you, Chair. And I should have asked this of the Secretary, but I suppose my line of questioning was kind of going in that direction. You know, if we were not to pass this legislation, do you think the office would be interested in maintaining a kind of informal relationship in which someone attended on a regular basis and, you know, could provide that kind of liaison that we're talking about?
So I do think so. I know that when I was walking back to the office with Secretary Brown, one of the points that she thinks is really a critical link is the relationship between the Common School Fund and the school board. Mm-hmm. And so I think that having a staff person, maybe, you know, who's a representative, maybe gets that. But I think the idea is that if you're constitutionally mandated to raise money for the school fund and you're not sort of directly related, I just think the expectation is you're going to do a better job with that link. But I do, to answer your question, yes, I think that people would be amenable to sending a staff liaison, as the governor does.
Great. Well, I think in any case, that would be great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you, Amy, for coming up on such short notice.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 428 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 538. And Senator Morissette.
This bill directs the Department of Education to seek public and private funding for the purpose of implementing programs that link physical activity and academic achievement, and to provide information to school districts about funds available for such programs. It allows the Department of Education to accept funds for programs from any source and agree to conditions placed on the funds as long as it's not inconsistent with the purpose of the program. Requires the department report to the 76th legislature regarding program funds applied for and received and information provided to school districts.
Thank you. Senator Morris, please.
Thank you, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Today is Senior Day. And if there are any seniors up there, I'm sure you would be wearing your yellow scarf, but I see that there are no seniors present. So hopefully you will all reach the magic moment. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. This is a bill that came about through the frustration of really not having PE in schools, and I've had a number of bills over the years. And I have a T-shirt with pictures of six people who killed all of my bills. They're, you know, Chuck Bennett is one of them. He's out in the hall, and I just told him to mind his own business today. But, no, unfunded mandates are not going to fly, obviously, and so we're not proposing a PE program, we're proposing a program that relates physical activity to learning, which the data shows a good connection between the two, and that's what we're here to talk about today. We're working with the Department of Education to establish a pilot project that schools could apply for. We want to have at least two schools, maybe a rural and urban, and they would have to bring something to the table. They would have to agree to do certain components of the program that would be able to measure the success in a controlled situation, because the data does show that if you exercise somewhat vigorously cardiovascular, that does stimulate the biochemical synapse in your brain and does help you learn. When I taught school for 30 years, I used to go out and run after school, and I felt absolutely wonderful. And I carried a notepad because I thought of all kinds of neat things to do while I was running. And so the other interesting connection is when Head Start visited the building about 2 months ago, I mentioned this to the Head Start people, and they said, oh, we're doing that already. We do get the kids moving. We stop everything, you know, and have them move, and they recognize that it is an aid to learning. So that's just kind of a quick overview, and we do have an expert witness today, Ann Summers, and I would like Ann to have an opportunity to describe a little bit about the program and her work.
Okay. Hi. Please. Thank you very much for having me here. Ann Summers. I have a brand new company based on 35 years of experience with wellness and health and fitness and so forth. And I would say health first and wellness and fitness second. When I met Senator Morissette, he asked me to weigh in as a member of the private community. I have a new company called Healthy in Oregon, and my purpose here is to take as broad an approach as I possibly can while maintaining effectiveness in infusing our state unit by unit, you know, preschools, schools, public entities, with the concepts of wellness, what that means, how it benefits us. Now, there's a complete reframe going on now based on neuroscience research of the last 15 years, and it's been especially strong the last 5 years, showing that however effective individually appropriate exercise is for the body, it is fantastically more impactful on the brain. So I have an article here that I just picked up on MSNBC, I think, that is representative of what we're learning now. If you want your kids to be smarter, literally take leaps in IQ points. Get them exercising, because the brain becomes awash in an element we call BDNF. And just in the last 15 years, we have found how critically important that element is. So I also have, you have a report that I wrote called Learning, the Mind and the Body, a New Integration. And I will go through this for a few minutes. And also in the back is implementation results of what is now called New PE. New PE is not just about exercise. It is absolutely not about sports exclusively, although that is a subcategory of it. It is about tapping into the body and therefore tapping into the best of our minds based on the new research. So this implementation results sheet shows what a company, the premier company in the country, it's a nonprofit organization based on the original founder, the original discoverer of how well our brains work after we exercise, and his company, his nonprofit company called PE for Life. And it shows here the increased levels of fitness when we allow our children to exercise and make it a part of their culture, the improved academics, absolutely outstanding statistics that I encourage you all to read, memorize, and report everywhere you can. And then, of course, decreased disciplinary incidences also occur in pretty impressive percentage points with at schools where PE is being used intelligently. So I would like to go through the neuroscience a little bit. I don't want to put you to sleep, so please speak up if you want me to speak. Speed on through that, I will. And thank you. And just to let you know, we have four more bills after this, so if we could carve out maybe another 10 minutes.
Okay.
I promise you I'll be done period of time. Within. Okay, so over the last few years, and again the 15 years, studies have definitively demonstrated that however important exercise is to the body, it takes a backseat to its importance on the brain. Individually appropriate cardiovascular exercise now is known to wash the brain in what in protein, a molecule called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And this is a factor in the brain that actually physically controls the quality of the brain's infrastructure. I think we're probably all familiar with the neurotransmitters dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin and so forth. These are the feel-good transmitters, and research until especially the last 5 years, focused on these feel-good neurotransmitters. But what we're finding out right now is that without BDNF, they don't have a highway to travel on. So BDNF controls the quality of the synapse. It controls the quality of the highway that these transmitters travel on, and it also controls whether the brain calls for these neurotransmitters or not, so the presence and the amount of their presence in the brain. So BDNF is stimulated by cardiovascular exercise. And from here forth, when I say exercise, what I mean is individually appropriate, vigorous cardiovascular exercise. Somebody should make an acronym for that, huh? Okay. So there is a direct correlation between the amount of BDNF in the brain and the amount of time a person exercises. And there, no limit has been found to how much BDNF you can accumulate in your brain or how long it lasts, but we do know there are lots of tests showing that if you exercise for, say, 30 minutes, then your brain will be awash in BDNF for about the next 90, perhaps 120 minutes, so an hour and a half, couple hours. And it is during this time, during that sweet spot, that our minds are most primed to learn. They engage the synaptic connections, are made more readily. We process information, data. We process data more readily. We are able to turn it into valuable information and knowledge more readily. We are also able to recall it better. So the entire process happens very much more effectively and efficiently and faster, as a matter of fact. So some of the studies on BDNF include, on how BDNF and exercise affect the brain, include a focus on attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, so ADHD and ADD, depression, very, very important, addiction, stress, anxiety, hormone balance, aging, self-modulation of disruptive behavior, and so forth. I'll go a little bit deeper into the science, not too much, and point out here serotonin helps modify brain activity that can lead to anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsiveness, and BDNF controls the presence of that and allows it to transmit effectively. Norepinephrine signals attention, perception, motivation, and arousal. Very, very, very important. You know, that's one of those feel-good ones. And then dopamine, the presence of dopamine affects learning, rewards, satisfaction, attention, and movement transmitters. So all of these elements are so tightly intertwined. So when the brain is stimulated to receive data, new activity occurs between the neurons, and when the synapse is effective, then we actually have a feeling. It happens within a portion of a second, up to as long as 8 seconds longer, or after the actual transmission of the successful physical transmission of the data, we know sometime later that we got it. We feel that. That's actually a physical process that happens. So, we've already covered that part. Neurotransmitters carry out the signaling, but BDNF is the infrastructure. So now when a neuron is stimulated, it's prompted to spring into action and grow new branches, dendrites, right? And that's where BDNF comes in, because BDNF, when it is stimulated a little bit, then it is stimulated more, and it gets into a positive feedback loop, and then it is called in to bring in the serotonin and so forth. And when this process, this unifying process between BDNF and the neurotransmitters occurs, then the brain is called upon to become alert. So the presence of BDNF not only includes the quality of information on the highway, it summons the neurotransmitters, tells them where to go. So BDNF, we are shown through thousands of research papers right now, show that BDNF is the critical biological link between body, mind, and feelings. It is the link between movement, thought, and emotion. And can I tell you, that's powerful. That's what education is about. That's what growing up is about. That's what learning is about. This is something that we absolutely need to pay attention to. So it's been called the master molecule of the learning process. And if we're not paying attention to that, you know, I don't think we're fully engaging ourselves as we need to be as adults and as educators. So with this master molecule, without sufficient quantities of BDNF, the learning process can be compromised and the mind's ability to retain existing information or process data and information into knowledge is compromised. There's a book that brought this body of knowledge to my attention, which I have shared with Senator Morissette, and it's a book by Dr. John Rady, who's an international expert on, among other things, ADHD. And the book is called Spark, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise in the Brain. It was published just several months ago, and it is causing a buzz around the world. Take a look at the newspapers, take a look online, and you will probably be seeing reference to this all over the place. So it was in 1995 that the original researcher, Dr. Kottman, nailed down the direct biological connection between movement and cognitive function. So by the fact that we are sitting here right now, we are really, really cutting edge. There are five other states that are looking to put or have already succeeded in putting exercise in schools, but none of them is taking a comprehensive approach as we are trying to do right here. So I'm going to back up a little bit, and I'm going to tell you about how all of this came about. There is a teacher, Phil Lawler. He's retired by now, but he's from Naperville, Illinois, and he read an article in 1990 showing how obesity was skyrocketing. Okay, long time ago, and being the intellectually honest human being that he was, he said, "I'm not doing my job. What can I do differently?" He was a coach. That was all he was asked to be and to do, but he realized that was not enough. So he started an exercise program, what he called zero-hour PE. And he found, just by observing, that those students who attended his zero-hour PE were all of a sudden accelerating their grades, accelerating their learning in the classroom. So then he hunkered down and really paid attention to this, and then the neuroscience. Then he started calling in doctors to come in and study, and PhDs and so forth, and then they began to identify why this was happening. So in the meantime, Phil Lawler started an organization called PE for Life. I was referring to that. And on the way, he continued to have his students take their most difficult classes immediately after their exercise. Ideally, the exercise is in the morning, but if they can't do it in the morning, they do it in the afternoon, and the BDNF seems to be able to show up whenever we ask it to. So in 1999, he sent his eighth graders to the TIMSS, the Trenton International Math and Science Study, and joined almost 250,000 other students around the world, and they ended up sixth in the world in mathematics. Sixth in the world. The first, the highest ranking Caucasian country, and I mean ahead of Finland, ahead of the Scandinavian countries. They were only behind, Singapore, Japan, the cultures that traditionally have a tremendous emphasis on math and science. But they were first in the world in science. First in the world from America. Okay? And I don't think anybody's ready to say that it was only the PE, the new PE, that influenced that, but no one yet has been able to come up with anything else that was different. Okay? They don't spend, the district did not have the money to spend outlandish amounts per student. It's not too different from what we have here. They just organized. So I've been talking about the brain benefits of what is sometimes called learning readiness PE, but there's also a nice side effect to PE. That side effect is that in Naperville, Illinois, and other school districts around the country where they have been implementing this for some time, their obesity rate is as much as 90% less than the average American obesity rate, 3% instead of 30 to 35%. So my summary is that I firmly believe that the best benefit is to the brain. It exercise, individually appropriate exercise, the best benefit is to the brain undoubtedly, but the side effect, and that is the short-term benefit and long-term benefit, but the most critical side effect is the reduction of tremendous health costs, both in physiological terms, social terms, financial terms, in the long run. So...
Thank you. Ann does work with various groups, consulting and wellness, and she was telling me that it's easier to work with the tribal people who, is that right?
Yeah. It was.
Who are open to doing the kinds of things that really help them than it is with the business community or the whomever.
Sometimes it can be, you know, a little bit of knowledge can be dangerous.
Yeah, that, yeah.
Among folks who think they're already healthy.
Yeah.
If they're not, then you have a barrier to break through, whereas my work with the tribes, they have shown astonishing progress in a very short period of time. Yeah.
And a little bit of knowledge being dangerous, we all understand that, right? Yes,
absolutely.
That's part of the occupational hazard.
Well, I think what we'll do now, so you may take off if you need to, Senator.
No, let me just say that, and I'll turn it over to Morgan here. What we have in mind is a pilot project. We are going to work on the content. We would like to do two schools. We would like the schools to have an application process, and they would have to bring something to the program because we want to create something that is measurable. We want to use this opportunity. There is no cost. The costs are being, we'll get to that in a minute. But this is an opportunity to show that we do have some alternatives at work. So with that, I'll let Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. In the interest of time, I'll be brief, but I think Senator Moore said approached the superintendent with this idea probably back in January or February to try to put together a bill, and then as it became more and more apparent that we were in the midst of an economic crisis and couldn't find any state funds to do this, we worked with Senator Morissette's office to craft a bill I think that will work for us. We do have a full-time PE education specialist at the department, and the way the bill's crafted is that, you know, if there are public and private funds available, whether from nonprofit resources or state or government resources, we will put a package together and try to find a couple of schools that would be interested in doing this. And I think, you know, as Senator Morissette described it very aptly, I mean, as we've said and learned about this, and I've talked to our PE education specialist, I mean, PE is not just dodgeball and running laps anymore. It really needs to change and adapt. And the science, for a non-science person like me, is very exciting. It's very easy to understand the link between, we all kind of intuitively know a fit mind and a fit body go together, but when you really start sitting down and looking at the science, it's really amazing and really fascinating, even for a non-science person like myself. So we're excited to be a part of this, and hopefully there are going to be some funds available to do this, and we appreciate working with the senator to craft a bill that would not have a fiscal impact on the department, and that hopefully we can put together a package of public and private funds and find a couple schools to do this. It'll be really exciting to see some results and bring some results back to the next session. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions? Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Many, many questions about neuronal plasticity and changes with age and circulating levels of BDNF and all that, but I don't think we should go into those things right here, right now. But I would love to talk about them in the future, okay? As for the tribes, we've got a couple of tribes within this building here. Maybe we could put together an experiment. I would love to go out and bike during lunch and then come here and see if I'm smarter and more productive. I'm sure I could drink less coffee and get the same activity level out of me. That's all.
Was there a question in there, Representative Harker?
Yeah, where do I sign up?
Okay, Representative Comp.
Thank you, Chair. I would seriously ask you to consider when you're looking at this as we progress with this. It wasn't all the time, but occasionally when we would have a special ed student, we actually wrote into their IEP at times for middle school students that we would back their science or math class right up after they had PE.
Oh, excellent.
And we never had a negative result from that strategy.
Oh, good for you.
But, you know, when you're looking at how to help students in every way possible, if you, you know, get to a subgroup, that might be interesting to verify some information there.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Springer. Morgan, on the PE, does the state have, it's been a while since I've been engaged with public school, do we still have a requirement for PE in schools?
Chair Springer and Representative Van Orman, yes, schools are required to offer PE, but there is no current in statute or rule sort of minimum standard that they have to adhere to right now. During the 2007 legislative session, this body passed minimum minutes per week standards for physical education and also required the department to collect information from school districts on the number of minutes that are offered in schools right now and sort of the facility needs that school districts have for PE. I think the reality is in a budget crutch, you know, things like music, art, physical education, those are some of the things that have suffered over the last decade or so in our public schools. Mm-hmm. We do have data. It has been shared with this committee. I'd be happy to share it again. We do have that information on sort of what school districts are offering and what their physical infrastructure needs are. But I can't remember the exact year, but I believe the new standards, it was Senator Courtney's bill, I believe the new standards, I want to say 2014, 2015, or 2015, 2016. So there's about, I believe there's about an 8-year phase-in built into that legislation that passed during the last session.
And a follow-up. And I would just like to comment to Senator Morissette about Head Start, of course, about the developmentally appropriate activities that address the whole child in that program.
Okay. Representative Roblin.
Yeah, I was just going to comment. My wife started doing that at Thayer Elementary School with a morning 45 minutes before school starts for a whole lot of kids and encouraged parents to get there and get their kids there, and they ran in the gym, did all sorts of physical activity. It has proven to be a very good, especially with those kids who are a little hyperactive. I mean, that was the key group. They come, they participate, and there's a lunch break, they can go out and run some more, they come back in, they handle the school day much, much better. So she's convinced that it does help kids manage themselves.
All for testing, we gave this stuff up.
I know.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really applaud what you're doing here. And it is great to see when the science starts lining up with one's intuition on something like this. Morgan, so as we kind of use the framework of existing resources or potential resources to do these pilots, are there some private sources that you've identified to make this possible?
Chair Springer and Representative Dimbro, that's going to be our task during this interim period. I think that's what we're going to need to do. We're fortunate that we do have a full-time PE specialist, and she's going to incorporate looking for, you know, funding resources for this type of a pilot project into her normal scope of work. We do a lot of information sharing with school districts. We apply for lots of federal and grants and other things. It's just sort of natural that that's going to be the big question is there going to be, you know, a foundation, whether it's a physical education foundation or a health foundation, or maybe in this stimulus money there might be some pot of money that we might be able to access that could fund this. And that's going to be the task of the department in this legislation. And I don't think there'll be any shortage of schools that would be willing to participate in this if there was resources available to do this.
May Ann comment on that?
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. Representative Dembro, I'm working directly with Phil Lawler at PE for Life. We spent 90 minutes on the phone the other day discussing what we're doing here. He is lauding us actively for taking the approach that we're taking. He also showed me a resource that they have there at PE for Life, being a nonprofit organization full of educators. They have compiled a list. I whittled it down to 30 possible private sources for that would be relevant for what we're doing right here. So I'll be working with Morgan and ODE to jump in.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Mallon, did you have a question?
I did. It's more of a comment. A lot of this activity, I mean, I'm fully supportive of all this. My comment and reaction is a lot of this is by modeling. And when they see mom and dad or aunt and uncle sitting on their behind, you know, in front of a television, it doesn't set a good example. And you know, the example is the cross-country teacher that drives along in a car smoking a cigarette, say, to his teammate, run faster, is probably not a good role model. That wasn't mine. It's actually my wife's experience. But the point is that it's long, you know, the kids are great, but we have to model it. And in fact, we don't model it in this building. We work really long and bizarre hours, and there's really no, there's no encouragement as a body to say, you know what, you reflect the state of Oregon, and we need to encourage exercise within this building.
Madam Chair, having studied the Montessori system when I was teaching and so on and talking about it, Maria Montessori started a program in Italy to help educate the parents because her idea was that if they teach the kids when they're ready to learn, the kids will go home and that will help the parents to understand what's going on. And I think this is the same thing. If the kids get really excited and the parents start seeing the results, then the kids will be the models, I think, and it will work in that direction. And there may be a lot of parents who just say, hey, that's fine, go ahead and do it, but don't bother me. And I think that when they see the results, they may become very enthusiastic themselves. So.
Other questions?
I could do one that's totally off topic. I could ask Representative Moore, I could ask Senator Marcet if he felt there was any inconsistency between this and, say, amusement type railroad systems.
I don't want to go there.
We have an issue.
You're right. That one's off topic.
We have an issue that Senator and I are working on.
Yeah, we're working on.
Sorry.
Well, thank you very much, all three of you, for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, I will.
Just wanted to give you the opening if you wanted to take it.
I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 538. And I'm going to open public hearings on Senate Bill 46, 47, 66, and 121. And Vicki. Yes. All of those, huh? Yeah. And if you
want
to.
Do you want me to give
a try? I would love that.
Senate Bill 46 is a fingerprinting bill that allows the Department of Education to require fingerprints. The amendment would allow them to use the Department of State Police to conduct criminal record checks for school purposes and for the Board of Education to pass the cost of that along to the school district. And then it provides for a process by which school districts can choose to employ someone who has knowingly made a false statement on a criminal conviction form. Senate Bill 47 authorizes the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to issue a public reprimand, suspend or revoke the right of an individual enrolled in an approved teacher education institution to apply for a license or registration, and requires the Standards and Practices Commission to notify school districts of suspensions and revocations. Senate Bill 66 allows the Department of Education to require fingerprints again in order to conduct criminal record checks for potential employees. And Senate Bill 121 requires first-time license or registration applicants to Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, to demonstrate knowledge of ethical standards of professional conduct as determined by the commission.
Thank you. If you will, Senate Bill 46.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the only two bills that I'm here to testify on today are 47 and 121. Would you like me to do that, or would you like me to wait?
No. I'd like you to do that. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
We should open
them.
You opened
I opened
thing?
All four.
Oh, you did?
Yeah,
yeah.
She did. Chair Springer, members of the committee, Senate Bill 47 came out of the work groups that we had during the interim that had the a group of discipline measures, and the issue is ever since the commission has been fingerprinting teachers, we have also been fingerprinting student teacher candidates. And what happens, I wouldn't say frequently, but frequently enough, is that we'll get record reports on candidates that are significant enough that if they were licensees, the commission would take action. I guess no one anticipated that when the law was first created. So here we get this information, and then there is we don't have any jurisdiction, because the way the statutes are written right now, our jurisdiction is only over applicants for a license or someone who already holds a license. We actually had a couple of cases this last time that were significant enough that what you would want is to take an action to deny the right to apply for a license in Oregon and then file it in the clearinghouse so that the other states would have notice, because we had one case that was significant enough and it involved actual child abuse issues and some other things. And then we learned that this person had left their teacher prep program in Oregon and gone to Idaho. And that only happened to come up coincidentally when I was having a conversation with the Idaho director. So this bill would close that loop and allow the commission to deny anybody who has a significant record. They'd have the same due process rights as anybody with a license, but it would allow us to take a step.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thanks, Matt. So they could be immediately removed from the classroom. That applies also.
Chair Springer, members of the committee, it has two actually fairly decent effects. One of them is we do these fingerprints sufficiently in advance before they're placed, so hopefully we're not getting the results after somebody's already been placed in their candidacy. But what happens is that higher ed, both public and private, get caught in a bind because they've admitted these people often into their programs, and their attorneys tell them they don't. What is the basis for having them leave? If the commission took action and said they're actually not eligible to be a candidate in the state, that allows them to drop the person from their program. And we have a situation right now where I know that a program felt compelled to continue to allow somebody to complete their program. I think they know they wouldn't be successful applying in Oregon, so I don't know what they're going to do about that. So it would allow us to ensure they're not placed in the classroom as a candidate, and it would allow higher ed to take some proactive step if they discover the person isn't eligible.
Okay. Representative Webber.
Many of these candidates are 18, 19 years old. And so, I mean, some of them are older, but there is a group, and you know, that are going through college and they've got introduced into program and they're doing that. So much of the record is juvenile record. Do you have access to that? And if stuff is expunged, does it still count against them if they're that age?
Chair Springer and Representative Roblin, actually about 90% of our applicants in our programs are from graduate schools.
Okay.
And frankly, I have only run across one juvenile record that was extremely alarming. We don't have access to the record per se. It was through candidate disclosure and some other things. The cases I've seen that have been disturbing, the individuals have been above the age of 25 because they did have a significant record.
Right.
as an adult. And to the rest of your question, we actually pay very close attention to the level of the crime as a juvenile. Did it involve injury against another person? Did it rise to a felony level? And then what is the legal effect after they turn 18? And we work that out with our attorney.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Van Ormer.
Thank you, Chair Springer. I am haunted by the number of bills that we've had this session for fingerprinting. And I go back to my statement, why don't we just fingerprint everybody and we'll have an identity card? But the question I really have, I really do have a question, is in regards to the statutes that, I'm presuming you have a list of statutes that would disqualify a student or a teacher from practice.
Chair Springer, Representative Orman, yes, we do. This bill would allow us to apply those crimes as a reason to deny somebody a future license.
Okay.
Right. We've been fingerprinting student teachers since 1993. We just haven't been able to do anything with the information, and this would allow us to do something with the information. So we won't be fingerprinting anyone new, and we would be able to proactively take action when we run into those few alarming cases.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions?
Clarifies that. Senate Bill 121 actually is sort of the other side. We often get asked the question, well, what are you doing to prevent misconduct? It's hard to prevent misconduct, but the legislature required TSPC to require a tested knowledge for civil rights, and this has been since the 70s, and the commission only just adopted an objective test to do this. But at the same time, the commission felt it was extremely important to include knowledge of ethics in the test, and that isn't expressed in the statute. And while we don't have to have legislation to do this, future commissions would be required to pre-test applicants for licensure on their knowledge of professional ethics. We believe that if people even have to go through the exercise of reading the ethical standards and being aware of them, you raise the level one step above just experiencing the standards if after they possibly misstep. So what this bill would do is it would incorporate into the portion of the statute where we do require knowledge of civil rights also that we would require knowledge of the professional standards of conduct.
Representative Van Ormer.
Thank you, Steve.
That was a question, right?
Yes, that was a question, yes. So are the universities and colleges, do they have curriculum on ethics so that the teacher, the potential teacher, would at least have some forewarning that this is an expectation?
Chair Springer, Representative Van Ormer, yes, it's uneven, I think, a little bit, but
okay.
Having knowledge that they have to prepare their candidates for this exam, actually, they're all preparing right now to sort of ramp up how they do it.
Okay.
In addition, what I gave you was a sample of the test.
Mm-hmm.
There is a study guide that goes with this for candidates, and we're working with a company to develop an online prep course if people would like to take that, you know, in order to obtain the knowledge. So we're trying to assist people. And the commission just set the score on the test. It isn't intended to be a high-stakes test. It's intended to be a test where people go through the exercise of demonstrating they've read the standards and they understand civil rights law. So,
okay. Thank you.
Representative Parker.
Thanks. Just as a minor part of this, you piqued my interest when you mentioned the IT aspect of it there. Has the money been appropriated for the development of that website there and also the web-based test? And
bless you. Chair Springer and Representative Harker, we're not paying for it. It would not be a commission enterprise. It's a company that's in California that actually was hired by the Catholic Church to do proactive training, who's interested in just providing that for Oregon. Their benefit is whatever they would take in. Our benefit is that it would be uniquely designed to help prepare them for our test. So no money had to change hands.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Representative Kimber.
Thank you. At what point would their knowledge of ethics be assessed, say, relative to their doing their student teaching? I mean, would it be before they do the student teaching, while they're doing the student teaching, after they're doing the student teaching?
Chair Springer and Representative Dimbro. You know, this is going to depend on the program. We do not require knowledge of ethics prior to their student teaching placement. So this would be prior to licensure. So it could happen at any time. The universities that are nationally accredited may require that as sort of a gatekeeper going into student teaching, but there's only 7 of those out of our 20. So that's the answer. Mm-hmm. I don't have...
Yeah, no, just follow up. I think that this is a great idea, but, the more proactive you want to be, sort of the sooner you should be expecting them to know that. And I would think that the schools of ed are working this into their curricula to really throughout, I would hope.
Chair Springer, Representative Dimbro, they have some different ways of delivering it. They all cover it. I think this exercise this last 2 years has really raised the level of what our investment is and who does what where. The commission has not mandated that they have to demonstrate knowledge before they do their student teaching. One of the conversations we're having with higher ed right now in preparation is how our preparation standards will look. And one of the things we definitely intended to do was require passage of the fingerprints prior to admission into the program, which actually settles that issue before they're already invested thousands of dollars in tuition and got up to the placement stage. So we'll take that into consideration. I think it's a really valid point.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Those are the only 2 bills, right, that you have? Okay. Okay. Let's talk about Senate Bill 46, Morgan Allen and Steve Howlett.
Hewlett.
I'm sorry, I apologize.
It's okay, everyone does the same.
Thank you, Chair Springer, and members of the committee. Again, for your record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. Joining me is Steve Hewlett, who is our Director of People, Transportation, and Fingerprinting, and we're here to talk to you about Senate Bill 46. Senate Bill 46 was a direct result of the interim work that was headed up by Senator Walker and Representative Buckley and Senator Cruz and many others in regards to, unfortunately for Representative Van Orman, the topic of fingerprinting. And there are 2 separate components in Senate Bill 46, and one has to do with fingerprinting for classified employees, and the other has to do with false swearing. So I'll address each one of those individually, and then Steve and I will be happy to answer any questions. But the first issue is, as you remember, and we've heard this in this committee, that the department is charged to provide fingerprinting and criminal background check services for the classified employees in school districts. So that's bus drivers, cafeteria workers, and other non-licensed staff. We do probably 20 to 25,000 of those checks per biennium. And if you look at the current statute, the reality in practice is that most school districts get their classified employees fingerprinted. But there is a tiny little loophole or crack in the statute that basically says you only have to get the full fingerprint background check if you have unsupervised direct contact or access to school children. So the kind of example of where a school district would not have to submit an employee to the department to get fingerprinted would be, say, like a graveyard shift custodian or a groundskeeper who only works on the weekends, because they conceivably in their job may never come in contact with children or be around students while they're attending school. I think the work group sort of looked at that and said, well, you know, everyone's basically fingerprinting all these people right now. We may as well go ahead and require that. So that's what Senate Bill 46 does. It makes sure that basically if you're going to draw a paycheck from a school district as a classified employee, you will get a fingerprint background check, period, whether you are there when kids are there or not, or whether, you know, you work on the weekend part-time, full-time. There's no wiggle room for a district to determine whether or not you may have direct unsupervised access to children. It's just everybody gets fingerprinted, period. So that's the fingerprinting portion of Senate Bill 46. The false swearing portion of Senate Bill 46 is a little bit different. Right now, or what this bill would do is it actually give the department some latitude and authority to make a determination whether a person knowingly made a false statement on a criminal history verification sheet. This issue was raised by several members of the work group, and I brought a. You should have a copy of our employment verification form. You'll notice down towards the middle, there's several questions. You've ever been convicted of a felony? You've ever been convicted of this crime? You know, the prohibited crimes are on the back of the sheet. That would you couldn't be a school employee or a teacher. And then there's another question that's basically like, are you really, really sure you've never been convicted of any crime? And it's that question that's the, are you really, really sure you've never been convicted of any crime that can be problematic for a lot of folks. Basically, right now, you know, let's say that, well, what the bill would do is what we intend to do is basically develop a process and criteria. Right now, if you falsely swear and say you've never been convicted of a crime, and let's say you have been convicted of a crime, not a crime that would prohibit you from being an employee of a school district, but let's say you had a minor in possession or a, some sort of traffic offense or other misdemeanor type crime that isn't on the prohibited list. If you say you've never been convicted of a crime and you were, you're done. You can't work for the school district during that round of applications. You basically have, you know, under the current system, you've basically lied on the form and you cannot be an employee of the school district. So, again, what we want to be able to do, and I think what the work group wanted us to do, was develop a criteria and process. And so to sort of give you two examples at the extreme of what we're looking at is most of the times when people false swear, you know, a lot of times we hear some very compelling stories, you know, they may have gotten, say, a minor in possession when they were in college and it might have been 25 or 30 years ago, or, you know, a misdemeanor marijuana possession in college, or some other silly transgression in youth. I'll use my own example. There was an unfortunate incident when I was 15 or 16 involved some bottle rockets and Roman candles in a farmer's field, but you know, it was a mistake, and not something that would, you know, I think most people would agree that would prohibit me from you know, seeking gainful employment later in life. So those are the types of instances where we'd really want to talk to the person, sort of look at the record, look at the crime, look at their explanation. The other thing that often happens, too, is in the electronic age and with storage records, there's no way for somebody to go back and prove maybe that it was expunged, or maybe they had a court-appointed attorney or the judge or the juvenile officer told them, that's going to come off your record, don't worry. They haven't thought twice about it. And a lot of times there's no way for people to go back to the court records and say, hey, this should have been expunged, because they only keep them so far back. Or, yeah, you know, if you live in Marion County, you know, there was a fire in the courthouse, tons of records were destroyed, you could never go clear your name. So those are the types of cases where we would want to give someone a second chance. Where we wouldn't give someone a second chance is, let's say someone checks on the box, I've never been convicted of the crime, we do the criminal background check, and let's say they've gotten 3 DUIs in the last 5 years. Well, that's pretty hard to explain away. I mean, that's pretty clear that the person is not giving us accurate, true information. And of course, we would just say, you know, we would deny their opportunity to work in the school district. So I think the intention with the false swearing and what the work group wanted to do is, I think everyone on the work group agreed that it was important to give a second chance to people who may have made a youthful mistake or have turned their lives around. And again, the important distinction is these are not crimes that would otherwise prohibit you from working in a school as a classified employee. They're more minor crimes. So, you know, it's really sort of the second chance act for classified employees. The bill did pass the Senate Education Committee unanimously. It passed the Senate floor unanimously. And we would hope this committee would pass the Angross version of Senate Bill 46 to the floor. So Steve and I would be happy to answer questions about that.
Did you have some testimony for us, or
no,
primarily
just
questions?
Some questions.
Okay. So. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Morgan, it's been months since I worked on the committee and listened to this, and I remember a lot of this stuff coming back as you talk about it. And I think there was a feeling of not one, if somebody made a legitimate oops, I did have that traffic infraction. But does the bill clarify that the department has discretion? I mean, because I remember talking in the work group about stuff like, you know, I forgot I was convicted of treason. You know, the A list and the B list. Where's the differentiation in the bill as to the discretion of the department when they answer no on C, I've not done anything on on A or B, is the discretion only on the B part, the traffic infractions, for example? I mean, I would assume we wouldn't have a lot of leeway on A.
Right, and I believe, and Steve can correct me, the B list is if you're a bus driver, those are automatically disqualifiers. Is that right? Or
yeah, for the record, Stephen Hewlett, Director of People Transportation, Chair Spencer, and Representative Huffman. The B list is at the bottom of that back page. That strictly has to do, C has to do with everything else, but B is mainly for driving, that we mainly meant for to be for school bus drivers.
And so, Representative Huffman, I think to answer your question, it's very clear that the A list and the B list for school bus drivers still apply. You can't falsely swear on that. You're disqualified no matter what. There would be, I think what we would need to do is develop a process. We already have a hearings process. Our legal affairs coordinator, Cindy Hunt, does those hearings when someone, you know, falsely swears and, oh, you know, oops, you know, I got busted drinking beer in college 30 years ago. Those things pop up, you know, it's kind of surprising that those things will still show up, you know, 20, 30 years later on the FBI checks. And so I think we feel like, and I think the work group felt like they could entrust our fingerprinting staff to sort of make those judgment calls. And frankly, if you ever have an opportunity to sit through one of these hearings or sort of talk to the people that falsely swear, it's frankly pretty easy to sort of tell who's telling the truth and who's not based on what the offense was and how long ago it was or the circumstances. So we feel like we can do a good job and sort of screen out people that would be unreliable. You know, I sort of use the extreme example of someone who falsely swears on, you know, maybe some more serious crimes, like maybe they have some theft charges, you know, and they're applying for a job in the business office as a classified employee for some reason. I mean, and they, you know, have two or three theft convictions. That would be something where it's like, no, we don't believe that you could possibly have forgotten that three times in your life you've been through the criminal justice system, you know, and charged and convicted of a misdemeanor or felony of whatever type. So I think that's really where we want to go with that.
Follow up. And I basically wanted to get on record, because that was a lot of the testimony in the hearings that we had, that, like, yeah, right, you forgot, you know. And so I just want to make sure that we had done some serious thought and clarification on what was going to be accepted and what wasn't.
Yeah, I think Chair Springer and Representative Huffman, I think, you know, Senator Cruz sort of summed it up best. I mean, really, you know, we want to give people who have truly turned their lives around and are seeking gainful employment, we want to make sure that there's a second chance. And because of the fact that, I mean, you know, I don't fully understand the TSPC process, but, you know, our process is very black and white, where the TSPC process, the commission has more latitude to sort of decide whether or not someone should be licensed when they're not dealing with the list of forever crimes or, you know, the forbidden list of crimes that you can't be convicted of. And so I think this sort of mirrors that process, so that it gives us a little bit more, and frankly, it is a little bit of a judgment call. I mean, you need to sit down and listen to the stories, and I don't think we're going to willy-nilly just say this or that is okay, but the examples that I know of false swearing, I mean, they're just so very clear. You know, they're often silly things like my circumstance, where, you know, the bottle rockets and the Roman candles went off a little further than we intended and got into the field, and the fire department got involved, and, you know, some other things happened.
Keep telling.
But I think that's really, those are the type of people who want to make sure can work in employment. And I think the key distinction on this is it is, again, it are crimes that if they just would have said yes, it would end a story. You never would have heard another word about it. We would just say they're cleared to work. So,
I've got a question. Maybe it's more of a statement, Morgan. My concern with this has been that we're very careful. You said the person that isn't going to forget that they have been arrested three times for theft or something. But I want to make sure that we're also talking about that person that's maybe only been arrested once. As most know, I spent many years as a deputy sheriff and put handcuffs on lots of people. I guarantee you, if it's only been one time, unless, and I don't say this jokingly, unless they've had a traumatic brain injury, they're going to remember that they've had handcuffs on and that their hands have been behind their back and they're very uncomfortable, and they've sat in a patrol car for absolutely no less than 10 minutes, and in my case, sometimes upwards of an hour that way. They're not going to forget that. And I want to be very clear that we're not talking about the person who forgets to mention that, because I just won't believe that they forgot they wore handcuffs. And Representative Huffman mentioned traffic infractions. Those don't count. And I can tell you, I can't unfortunately tell you, remember exactly how many traffic infractions I've received, but I think it's more than one. And so that's a different case. We're talking about crimes. Mm-hmm. And people that are arrested for crimes almost always lose their freedom. You remember when you lose your freedom once. And I guess there was no question in there. That was just a statement. And Representative Thatcher,
yeah,
did you have something?
I had a question about the current law. Like, if somebody forgets to write down something, are they banned for life from reapplying, or is there like a period of time?
Chair Spencer and Representative Thatcher, no, they're not banned for life. You know, depending on the school districts, sometimes school districts have, you know, they have the opportunity that if they want to let them, you know, if they went back to the district and said, you know, I'd forgotten about this that it happened because I went through a diversion program, and my lawyer told me that if I went through a diversion program, that it would be off my record. Well, it could have been a DUI diversion, which it is off their driving record. Only problem is it stays on their criminal record. So they truthfully may have thought that they were answering truthful. And so then they'll go back to the district, and some districts will say, okay, you know, what? Tell us what happened, and then they go through, and the district will actually let them reapply and go through a new fingerprint process and answer truthfully this time. You know, but if they, you know, they contend that they did this and we find other evidence, and like I said, there's three or four times and when they've had the handcuffs on, usually that's something you don't forget. I know, I remember a long time ago, but you don't forget that. You'll never forget that case. So, but a lot of people think that they've had those things dropped off their record. So it doesn't seem that they can't ever go in. If they reapply to another district and the district can answer truthfully, we would clear them because, again, these are not crimes that would keep them from working with students. These are just other crimes.
Representative Roble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, the only thing I'm having looked at lots of these and had dealt with a couple situations like we're talking about, I always thought that C should be A. And the first question should be asked, have you ever committed any crime, which could be a misdemeanor, a felony? So it just comes right off the bat, and then they check it. And then the next one is, were any of the crimes that you committed listed on the back A? And then they would go through there. Because I think sometimes they get in the habit, they've done, you know, they didn't do either of those, and they think, oh, okay, those are the only ones they really care about. And then they come to three, and it is said differently, but they were already in the mindset that it was the other two that they were really worried about. And so they get confused. And I mean, the ones that I would do were things like yours, and then all of a sudden there is no way to get out of it. But I think if the first question answers, have you ever committed a crime, I think personally the form would be more clear for those people because you get them thinking about all these really horrible crimes back here because they're looking through all these things and they think, whoa. And then when they ask them if they've committed a crime, it's kind of like the only thing that's on their mind is all these crimes. And, you know, I'm
filling out the form.
So they don't want to say they've done anything. And so it's just a mindset thing for me that I think in talking to people who have been shook up by that particular thing, that if you just ask them front, you know, and they weren't already looking at all these horrible things that other people have done, they'd be more likely to say, oh yeah, I remember that time, and check it. But they get, after they've read these other two, it's kind of like, God, if I sign this, I'm all done. I can't do anything. So it puts them in this mindset. And that's the only thing that I would recommend that you think about on the form.
And Chair Springer and Representative Bellman, just if I didn't make this clear for the committee, there already is a process where people can contest their false swearing, but, you know, almost 100% of the time we have to say sorry. You know,
I know.
We understand that you didn't understand the form, or you thought this was going to come off, or you forgot about your youthful indiscretion, and we just have to say sorry.
Yeah. Representative Maurer.
Thank you. Can you go through the process for me and how from where are we in this as far as how are the fingerprints taken, where are they taken, you know, let's go back to your in college, you go through your teacher training program, student teaching, then you go out and look for a job. How does that, who gets what information and where?
Well, Chair Springer, Representative Maurer, we can't speak to the teacher part of it because we only do the classified employees. So I don't know if Ms. Chamberlain's still here, but Steve would be happy to sort of walk through our process and how we do the classified employees, so the non-teaching, the non-licensed staff,
okay,
the people that aren't licensed by TSPC.
Okay, Chair Springer and Representative Maurer. It starts with a person applies for a job and they fill out this form. And either the district will have somebody that does the fingerprinting on staff, some okay. large districts do that, or they'll send them down to the county sheriff or the city police that has a place to do fingerprinting. They then send that form along, you know, after it's been notarized, along with the fingerprint cards into our department. We give it a sequence number, put it into a data.
Do they have to send it to you, Department
yes.
of Education?
Yes.
There are no exceptions in the state.
No. They have to send it.
Portland isn't one of these.
Not
everybody applies.
Not for classified.
Everybody goes through Department of Education.
Everybody goes through the Department
okay.
of Education.
Thank you, sir.
So then we give them a sequence number. It's put into a database. We then pull that off, and we send it over to the state police and the FBI, which they then run the background checks,
right.
you know, nationwide. Then through the LEDS system, electronically, they send us a response, and where it's cleared, then we just clear them, and then we send a copy of that form back to the district. If we find that there's been, you know, some record, we check to make sure that they answered truthfully, especially if it's under C, then we, you know, and they did mark truthfully, we would also clear them, because again, that doesn't keep them from working. If there's anything that we find under A and B, and whether they marked yes or no, then we have another process, so we send a letter, you know, saying that, yeah, your record shows that this has been, you have 10 days to respond, you know, to ask for a hearing. You know, if you don't hear from a hearing, then we send a letter to the district that basically tells the districts they have to terminate this person. If they ask for a hearing, then we set up a hearing date, we go through the hearing process. You listen to it just like a small court, then the hearings officer then makes a judgment, and then at that point, whether the Department of Ed wins the case or loses, they'll get a response back to the department, which then there's another process that if they want to revoke it, they can take it to the appeals court for a final.
And Chair Springer, Representative Maurer, one other thing, too. We also have statutory authority to do background checks for volunteers, school volunteers and coaches at district discretion. And private schools can also, if they choose, have their staff fingerprinted or LEDS checked through the Department of Education. And we do have a lot of private schools that take advantage of that service as well.
What does the district get? At the end of this process, what does the school district get?
Chair Springer and Representative Maurer, that form that you have, that you see, that's an NCR form.
Yes.
And if you look down in the bottom right-hand corner, you'll see there's a check mark where it has, like, you know, been cleared. There's a check mark, ABC, a little place for a signature down there. There's one of the forms that we send back to them with that signed off, showing that they have cleared through our system. And then the white copy, the made copy of that, we keep in a file downstairs, and we're required to keep those for like 30-some years as far as in a record base. And again, they have a sequence number on it so that if, say, an employee went to another district and they said, well, they said they were fingerprinted at Reynolds and they're going to work for Portland. Have they been fingerprinted? Well, we can look them up either through a sequence number or a Social Security number, and then we can send them another copy saying they have already cleared here and we have records of that, and we can send them a copy of that, what you're looking at.
So do you know, does the Department of Education know what position they're being hired for?
Senator Chair Spencer and Representative Maurer, yes. It says on that form up there, there's usually a position right up in there that they explain.
Oh, held.
If it's,
okay.
You know, educational assistant, bus driver, cook, you know, or whatever. But there is a place for them to put that in.
So if they were hired, I'm sorry, but if they were hired for a business office, because I don't see, and I'm not a lawyer, in law enforcement, embezzlement. I mean, embezzlement isn't listed here. I don't think it is. Maybe there's other words for it. But, and you're applying for, not an accountant, but for a...
Yeah, there you go. Business manager.
Not even business, just an accounts manager, secretary, working in the business office. I think it'd be really important, that, they're not on the... It's not on the list... Does little red flag go up?
Chair Spencer, Representative Maurer, they might fall under some of the theft things that are listed on the back. And again, if it was a business manager, they would be not a classified employee. So that would not go through our system. Same with like a, superintendent or somebody like that. We don't put them through. They're not considered classified employees. They were administrative employees.
I wasn't, not the business manager. I'm talking just a, you know, your bookkeeper.
If they were a classified employee, they would go through the same process. Some of those are generic listings, and there may be other listings like embezzlement or something under like theft at a rate or burglary.
Madam Chair, it would depend sort of on the collective bargaining agreements that the school districts have at the district level and how they classify their employees and whether folks in their administrative offices are considered classified employees for purposes of collective bargaining. It's really probably on a district-by-district basis.
Committee, we have one more bill we need to hear. And I know Representative Thatcher wants to testify on this bill here. So if there's another burning question, we'll go there. Otherwise, we'll thank you two gentlemen. We'll have you back for, I think, 121.
Madam Chair, I have one burning question.
Okay.
Who's held responsible if they had a background problem and you said they were cleared and they were hired and they did something wrong and somehow somebody found out that they had a background and you cleared them? I mean, it seems to me the school district is still where the buck stops.
Chair Springer, Representative Maurer, I don't think either Steve or I are probably of legal eagle mind to answer that question, but if they are cleared by, you know, through the FBI and the state police processes, I don't know what kind of liability a district may incur if it were found out later somehow that something was missed on those checks. I don't know the answer
to that. No, I mean, I'm saying your Department of Education said they're cleared.
Well, Chair Springer and Representative Maurer, we would only say they're clear if the FBI and state police tell us they're clear. Because they're the ones that actually do the checks and tell us whether or not.
Yeah, but you said you had discretion.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I think I'm starting to see your point here, and very quickly. You get the fingerprints, and they come back, and they haven't been convicted of something here, and you say they're clear. You say they're clear. But they have been convicted of something else that isn't here. That's your point, right?
Of something. And you just said you had discretion to, you know, they phoned up, said, yeah, I was, you know.
Chair Springer and Representative Maurer, what we're asking for is discretion for people who commit false swearing to have some latitude to determine whether or not they made that false statement knowingly or were trying to hide something or frankly were lying to us. That's what we're asking for. So that's, I think, a little bit different than what you're describing. But
you are correct. It is different.
Yeah.
Okay, I think what we're going to do, because I don't think this issue is resolved. I know there's somebody else wants to chat about this, but I want to get Representative Thatcher up there. We will post this again when it's a work session. We'll also have a public hearing. So this is not our last opportunity, and it might be a good opportunity offline to get together with some of these issues and address them so we can have a clearer understanding when we come back next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And then we'll come back to Senate Bill 66 here briefly.
Thank you. For the record, Kim Thatcher, State Representative Kaiser, St. Paul and Newburgh. And I did want to testify towards to the Dash 4 amendments. This is basically what Madam Chair, you and I presented last month, and it would just allow local school districts to go directly to the Oregon State Police to do background checks instead of going through the Oregon Department of Transportation. That's what's the first thing listed in Section 7, and it would save money, and it would provide better information to the district. When Oregon Department of Education runs a check, they only tell the school district, like you heard, if they're clear, if they didn't have anything that's on the unwaivable list. I think it was an interesting line of questioning that we heard from Representative Maurer, because you could potentially have a classified employee who has been convicted of something that might affect their performance, maybe, in a business office or whatever, if they are handling money or what have you. If they're misdemeanor crimes, they don't get reported to the district, and the district might want to know that. the legislation that's proposed doesn't require the school districts to do anything. It just gives them the option to get their background checks from the state police instead of going through the Department of Education. Like I said, it does save money. The last time we talked about the bill, the ACLU had concerns about a small town and a rumor mill, so this amendment would fix that. It would require the districts to keep that information confidential. It would also allow the school districts to run through the OSP checks on their volunteers if they want to. We had an LC opinion last session which says that school districts are not authorized under current law to do that, so we wanted to fix that. This doesn't require districts to check all volunteers, though that would be nice, because the only difference between a school employee who abuses kids and a volunteer who abuses kids is a paycheck. And I was talking about being haunted by all the fingerprinting bills. I'm haunted by all the headlines involving abused students, and I think most of us are. And so that's why the recommendations came out to from the interim work groups to go towards this. Several districts are frustrated, and it's just this would give them the ability to do that. We talked briefly about Portland School District doing this, and that's simply because they have a police department within their school district, and so they are able to go through LEDS checks and do all these things directly, whereas most school districts don't have their own police department. So, and they are in support of the Dash Force.
Okay, thank you. And we're not working the amendments today. We'll be bringing this back, and I've indicated to Keeley that there'll be some time allotted for this. We'll pass that on to the chair. So before the work session, that hopefully that there'll be a public hearing, because I think there's some unresolved issues with this for sure and some more discussion. So thank you.
Thank you.
Would you like to return, gentlemen? And we will hear Senate Bill 66 very briefly. Is the other committee starting to show up?
Thank you, Chair Springer, and members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen, Department of Education, back with Steve Hewlett, our Director of People, Transportation, and Fingerprinting. And we're here today asking for your support of Senate Bill 66, which would give the department statutory authority to conduct criminal record checks, much like the school districts and other state agencies that we've been discussing here today. You have my written testimony coming around, also a copy of an executive order from Governor Kulongoski that gives the department the authority to conduct a LEDS background checks. But essentially what Senate Bill 66 would do would put into statute the authority for the Department of Ed to request a LEDS check or a full FBI fingerprint background check for agency employees, applicants for employments, contractors, and volunteers. Again, we have the authority to do the LEDS checks under executive order. It's important to note that the language in Senate Bill 66 is permissive, and it's not going to mandate that we do fingerprint background checks on all of our employees, applicants, contractors, or people that come and volunteer at the departments. You know, there'll be rulemaking involved. The State Board of Education will ultimately have the final say on the folks that we decide to do that. And I think our intention is to mirror very closely, you know, the list of crimes that would prohibit you from being a school teacher or a classified employee. That would probably be our starting point. As Representative Maurer was discussing a little bit earlier, you know, in the rules, I think we're kind of thinking, you know, for our folks in our accounting and finance unit who literally handle billions of dollars, we might want to put into administrative rule that you couldn't be convicted of, you know, certain fiduciary crimes, for example, that we might want to screen prospective applicants or employees for as well. So this bill was not part of the package from the interim work group. It's a little addition from us, and as you know, there's a whole host of fingerprinting bills. But it is true that a lot of our employees do have potentially have unsupervised access to children, or some of our contractors may have unsupervised access to children. The folks that we do, and obviously the folks that teach at like the Oregon School for the Deaf and Oregon School for the Blind that are licensed teachers already undergo the appropriate background checks, as well as the classified employees. employees that teach at our institutions. So we believe it's prudent to grant the agency the authority to do that in sort of light of the larger discussion we're having about protecting students. And this language was crafted. Many other large state agencies have this language in statute. There was no opposition to the bill. We made a couple minor amendments in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where this bill actually came out of, at the request of the ACLU. And it did pass the Senate unanimously, and we hope you'll send it to the floor and pass it along to the governor for his signature. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Did you have anything to add or available for questions?
Just available for questions.
Okay. Any questions?
It's getting more fun now.
Yes. Representative Van Orman. So this basically applies to some people that you might have on a personal contract to do specific work for a short period of time and not necessarily an employee.
Chair Springer and Representative Van Orman, yes. It would allow us to do that for contractors, vendors, or volunteers if we chose to. It's permissive. It wouldn't require everyone to do that. It would allow us at our discretion to perhaps do checks on folks.
Public hearing closed, then I'm going to open it. You don't even have to open it.
Any further questions? Thank you. That was brief. I would love to hear sometime the story regarding the fireworks.
It did involve the Linn County Juvenile Authority, but that was a long time ago.
That's probably enough information on the record.
It should be expunged.
Thank you.
It absolutely is. Fortunately, my mom worked at a law office, so it helped me get that expunged.
That was far too much information. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 46, 47, 66, and 121. And I did not and will not open, correct?
Right, just to carry
over. The public hearings and work sessions on Senate Bill 115 and 120.
Monday.
And I'll carry those over.
Yes.
And Senate bills, carryover Senate bills 115 and 120. And then I'm waiting for Representative Roblin to say wrong tap or something.
You didn't really agree.
And then I did not, and we're not doing anything with Senate bills 48 or 119. Those will be rescheduled. Okay. Committee is adjourned.
Good. Yeah. Those are yours.
Yes.
I think those are yours.